This is Not Quite Dead,
a Gal Pal horror movie discussion podcast.
We do deep dives on our favorite scary movies.
But sometimes we really just like to keep it shallow.
I'm your host, Kate.
I'm Megan.
Get ready for all the spoilers.
I thought I could hold a grudge, but I don't know the first thing about grudges. This ghost is for real.
You're not going to haunt every person that comes into your vicinity until the end of time?
I should. I'd probably be a lot happier that way. But no, I don't plan on doing that. We are talking about The Grudge, obviously. Great 2004 ghost movie in the same vein as The Ring.
Yes, and very similar vein as The Ring. It is an early 2000s remake of a Japanese movie. There are some differences, though, because The Ring was directed by Gore Verbinski for the American version, whereas The Grudge remake was actually directed by Takashi Shimizu, who was the original director for the Japanese version.
Which was super cool, and it even included some of the original actors from the original The Grudge. That family was all the same from the Japanese original.
The original only came out a few years before the American version came out. The original came out in 2002, and that is such a quick turnaround for a remake.
Really quick. They must have seen how well The Ring did and said, hey, we're not waiting. We're doing this. This is going to be good.
Yes. And they were ready to bring this to an American audience since The Ring did so well. But also, the director was really eager to sign on because he felt like there were things that he could improve on from the original movie in this next one. So it was kind of like he got a redo on some stuff.
And I'm assuming a bigger budget to do stuff with.
Almost certainly. The budget for this one was $10 million. And
holy moly.
I know that there was some interesting critical response to it, but it did gross $187 million.
Yeah, it did great. And they have a few sequels and a reboot, which I haven't seen and I didn't even realize had happened.
I am right there with you. I have not been keeping up with any sort of franchising around the Grudge movies. I feel there was this big kind of push around J cinema and Asian horror remakes for American audiences in the early to mid 2000s. And then it kind of fell off. I mean, there's been a bigger resurgence lately with Korean horror and Korean cinema, especially with Parasite and everything. But Japanese horror kind of cooled for American audiences probably after 2010.
Yeah, but it really primed us for Korean horrors and Chinese films. It really, I feel like, ushered in a new wave of Asian takes on these types of topics. It's a pioneer.
Definitely. And there are actors from the original in this one, but also some familiar faces, too, for American audiences. The biggest, of course, being Sarah Michelle Gellar.
Yeah, she was pretty hot at the moment. I want to say this is not too long after I Know What You Did Last Summer and the Scream sequel. She was doing a handful of these horror movies and also teen movies. She was just one of those hot actresses at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Now she's kind of dropped off the face of the earth because she's got a great husband and a great life. But she was pretty popular. Yeah, I love it.
I recognized Clea DuVall, who's in this too.
Oh,
she's kind of a side character. She's great. She's not in enough stuff.
She's not, and yet she is in everything. I see her all the time, but she's never the star, I think, is why she sort of fades away into the background. But she's another one of those people who was in every teen movie just as a background character at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Most recently, I've seen her in Veep. And she is fucking hilarious. She's like super deadpan. She's this lesbian. It's fun. She's a very straight lesbian. She does not mess around. She doesn't goof off. And it's just very funny to see her in that role. I highly recommend Veep. Jason Baer was a recognizable face, but he's not really a hugely well-known actor. I remember him from Roswell, which was a long time ago.
I was not as familiar with the other actors. Jason Baer wasn't familiar to me. Katie Strickland is in this, as well as William Mapother. We have the 90s mom. Grace Zabriskie is in this. She plays Laura Palmer's mom in Twin Peaks. She's also in Seinfeld. I was pleasantly surprised to see her in this.
Yeah. And of course, Bill Pullman. I haven't seen him a lot lately, if at all. I want to say his claim to fame for me is Independence Day as the president.
Oh, I think that's his claim to fame for a lot of people.
Okay.
Yeah.
I was going to see what you came up with, Kate, but it sounds like it's the same thing.
Oh, it would be that. Bill Pullman's one of those actors where I'm like, oh yeah, he's a famous man, but I couldn't name a lot of stuff that he's in. I just have this blind spot towards actors of a certain genre and era, I suppose.
A lot of the cast is filled in with Japanese actors who I'm not familiar with. Anybody notable worth calling out?
Yes. We have Ryo Ishibashi. He was in several other Japanese horror films, notably Audition. Audition is a great, great, great Japanese horror film. Would love to cover that on the pod one day. Yoko Maki, who plays Yoko in this movie, was also in Infection. And Takako Fuji, she was in the original The Grudge.
Yeah, a lot of good actors in this.
This is a funny one because it feels like it has some strong bones to the premise. It's riding off of this wave that The Ring started. It's got well-known American and Japanese actors in this. Rotten Tomatoes was 40%, which for a horror movie is like pretty good. A lot of horror movies kind of like cap out on average at 55%. So I saw 40% and was like, okay, that's not the worst thing ever. But I feel like I remember when this movie came out that people didn't like it and they were just dunking on it for ripping off The Ring.
All right. I'll just say my memory fails me because I don't remember that. I remember feeling excited to see it. And when I saw it, thinking, oh, good, another different movie. I got that it was similar to The Ring in terms of style and it being a mystery and there's a ghost at the center of it, like an angry ghost. But the story to me felt wildly different. It felt unique. It felt like something I had never heard before. It went into Japanese folklore. And so I didn't really understand the rating on this movie. And I still don't. I was looking at some of the reviews that came through and everyone was just saying it's too similar. I certainly have a bone to pick with that statement.
It feels, especially watching them in close proximity to each other, like they are very different movies. It feels, I'm going to bring out the R word, a little racist.
Yes, I was thinking the same thing.
For people to say, oh, we had two Japanese stories being told in a short period of time, and that's just too much for an American audience. I don't agree with that at all.
Oh my God.
They're so different.
Incredibly different. And I'm going to take a minute to go on a little tantrum tangent to talk about Marvel movies.
Yes.
The most similar movies of all time. They come out multiple times a year. What's the plot? You meet a superhero. You have to deal with the backstory for an hour. Then you have to deal with the first fake story with a fake villain. Then the villain becomes the friend. Then the villain and the hero go and fight somebody else together for the last hour. It's so cookie cutter. And I know I'm oversimplifying here, but Kate, you've seen a lot of Marvel movies.
I have.
That happens a lot, right?
Oh my gosh. I have stopped watching Marvel movies because I was tired of watching the same thing over and over and over again.
Right.
And I was the kind of person who would go watch them in theater the weekend that they came out, if not the day they came out, for all the phase one, phase two, phase three stuff. But now it's just oversaturated. It's gimmicky and it's boring at this point.
Well, do you want to guess what the average rating is for Marvel movies, the Marvel Cinematic Universe movies?
Probably 90%.
You're close. It's 81%.
Okay. Percent. Okay. Yeah.
I mean, we had Black Panther nominated for a best movie. Ugh, Kate. To be living in this Marvel era and to go back and hear that The Ring and The Grudge are too similar and therefore The Grudge got a low rating, I was like, that's not right. That's totally off. I'd like to take a quick side note to mention to our listeners that Kate and I are working on getting Rotten Tomato certified. We would like to also contribute to this amalgamation of opinions and take part in the tomato meter score. One of the requirements for that is that we have 200 ratings in Apple Podcasts. So if you don't mind taking a minute, going and giving us a 5-star rating, letting Apple Podcasts know what you think of our podcast, we'd really appreciate it. But let's get back to The Grudge. Are we ready for a plot summary?
I think we are. I am going to give us the plot summary in sequential order, not in the order that the movie gives it to us, because the movie does this time skipping back and forth and some flashbacks. It's a little convoluted to try and relay in a sound bite. So in sequential order, there is a Japanese family living in Tokyo. The mother of this family has an obsession with her professor, and her husband, in a jealous rage, drowns their son, their cat, and his wife because he thinks that she might be having an affair with this American professor. This creates a vengeful spirit out of the mother and a ghost out of the little boy who then kills the husband. This house is now haunted. And so an American family moves into the house shortly after, and the family gets terrorized by this ghost. A caretaker for the elderly mother is pretty brutally killed. The husband and wife are killed as well. Sarah Michelle Gellar's character is then brought in as a new caretaker within days after this happening. And she starts kind of digging into this mystery of what is happening with this house, what's going on. The nonlinear narrative is really trying to make us try and figure out what happened to the original family in this house, but I already gave up the ghost on that. Haha. And so the rest of the movie kind of follows with Sarah Michelle Gellar trying to unravel this plot while people are being killed by this ghost around her pretty much anytime they come into contact with the house. And that's the plot.
So we're in Japan, but we're following a bunch of white people.
Yes.
It kind of threw me for a loop. The first time I saw it, I was like, oh, I guess Americans just move to Japan all the time. How else did these guys intersect?
This is my bone to pick with this movie. Oh my gosh, it kills me. Okay, because it kills me because it is assuming that American audiences only have a palate for seeing American actors in things, which is probably true for the most part.
At that time.
At that time, yeah. You know, this is 20 plus years ago. I looked it up because I was curious how many Americans actually live in Japan. And in the year 2000, there were only 58,000 North Americans total living in Japan. Japan is not known for its open immigration or no. Like in general or multiculturalism. And so... No. This movie being focused around like not just one white family, but multiple circles of white people being involved with each other just feels really disingenuous to the actual experience of Tokyo. But it kind of felt like a little movie hand waving happening.
You've watched that show Old Enough, right?
I have. Yes, I love it.
It's adorable. It's a Japanese show about toddlers going through their first task. And the task usually involves traveling outside of the home, going on a shopping spree, and coming back with the groceries and change. And the point is, this is a cultural thing. Everyone does it. The communities support it. They watch out for the kids. Very traditional Japanese thing. One episode featured a couple where the husband was from New Zealand, and he couldn't quite let go. He couldn't let his kid finish. Like, he wanted to go and help him. And you're not supposed to do that. You're supposed to let them finish, cry it out, whatever. Encourage them to complete the task. And the entire time, the narrator is just ripping on this New Zealander. And he's just like, is he gonna let him finish? Is he gonna let this kid be a baby about it? You know, they're just picking on this guy. And then eventually he moves out of Japan. And it was just very funny the way he was the odd man. This family was very much the odd family on this show. And I think that kind of relates back to this. It doesn't make sense that all of these white people are intersecting so hard in this movie.
No. And Sarah Michelle Gellar in this role is supposed to be a caretaker, like an in-home nurse type person who doesn't speak Japanese. She can say basic pleasantries, but she seems a little notably distressed when she's getting an actual in-home placement until her also white manager assures her, oh, don't worry, it's an English language household. You'll be fine. I don't think you get to move to a monoculture like Japan and not integrate. I don't think that that's how that works.
Right. And she's an exchange student. Mm-hmm. So you'd think she would know better or have some of the culture under her belt or the language. Is she just there to, is she the one bringing her boyfriend there, or is her boyfriend the one bringing her there?
Well, her boyfriend's a waiter.
Because he's just a waiter.
Yeah. So yeah. I think we're supposed to think that maybe they met there. If you think about it, in Japan, there are 58,000 total North Americans living in Japan at the time. There's 126 million people living in Japan total. So 0.04% of the population are North Americans. And I think all of them are in this movie.
Oh, my goodness. And it looks like they've been living there a while. Their apartment is all decked out and very homey. And
it's very Western, too. They have a big bed.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
And how convenient that she got the only English-speaking family to take care of.
I know, because very similarly, this family moved out here for his job, but then his sister also got a job out in Japan, too. It just doesn't seem like it would be that easy. If we're going to suspend our disbelief, at least yeah. It's very beautiful. The house that they move into is a very beautiful kind of traditional style Japanese house. It's in Tokyo, which has just some beautiful trees and like gardens around the area where the house is. So that's all cool, at least. They're not just giving us a faceless Tokyo or like a set piece or something. We don't get any Japan at all.
Yeah, I do kind of wish they went more into the day-to-day life of what it's like to be in Japan. They kind of skim over that. They don't really go into detail there, but you do get a sense of the lifestyle when you tour this house through the movie. Totally bizarre that this entire family has moved to Japan for this sick mom. It's for the sick mom. It's for the job. But the sick mom is there too. Everybody, like, why does there's like multi-generations coming to Japan together?
I know they pick up their whole family and move them to Japan, and that's not easy. Clea Duvall's character at one point, she's like distressed because she got lost, and she's like, and I tried asking for help and no one could speak any English. And I was like, okay, Clea Duvall.
No shit.
I want to get into some of the deaths in this movie.
Ooh, yes. We had a great kill count. And we should probably preface it with the rules, or what we think are the rules for getting killed by a ghost in the first place.
Yes, definitely. It seemed like it was very oriented around the house.
Yes. If you entered the house, you were a goner. For the most part, the detectives get killed. Yoko's boss, all he does is come in to check on things. He's there for a minute. Yoko, who was there for about a day, if that. I want to know about the realtor, though. Why didn't the realtor get it? He knows about the house and he's been trying to sell it for a while, but he's still alive.
That's a great question. Yeah, why did the realtor not get it if all these other people did?
I have a theory about the realtor that kind of does relate to The Ring. If we remember in The Ring, what saves Naomi Campbell is making a copy of the tape and sharing the wealth so to speak, of the ghost. The realtor in this case is kind of doing the same thing. He is bringing new families into this house for the ghost to enact its vengeance upon. And I think there is a thread here to the Onryo spirit, which is Japanese folklore angry ghost. In order to placate them, you would deify them. You give them offerings and worship them. I'm wondering if this is a step away from that or kind of along that vein. By giving the ghost what it wants, you are sort of worshiping it in a way.
Yeah, that's a really great theory. I love that. The Onryo belief is all about the vengeful spirit, and particularly women who've had unjust deaths, who are traumatized by what happened to them during their life and are looking to get revenge. And so Samara from The Ring, great example of an Onryo. Kayako in this movie, a very obvious Onryo character. I could totally see that. You know, the ghost is like, oh, you're feeding me. You're giving me an outlet for this revenge and vengeance. And so I'm going to spare you because maybe you'll bring me more later.
So you need to go into the house in order to get on the ghost shit list. But the ghost doesn't necessarily have to stay in the house to kill you, which is really scary. And I was not expecting.
We talk about that in other movies where, you know, usually I'm complaining about, you know, what are the rules here? Sometimes people will seem to only be tied to the house and then they randomly kill someone in a car or something later. And it's just so frustrating. But this one, it really does feel like, okay, there's an inciting event, which is entering into the house, and then the ghost is then attached to you until it's able to kill you. Because it happens for so many different characters.
Yeah, and nobody else can see it.
And no one else can see it.
Yes, let's get into this kill count.
Yes, I actually loved the first death, which is maybe not technically a kill count because it is a suicide, but it's Bill Pullman. He right away just like yeets himself off a balcony, and we get this like insane zoom effect happening as he's plummeting towards the concrete. And then I remembered that this was produced by Sam Raimi, and I was like, right,
right.
I
did not understand that death, to be honest with you. It would take way more than that for me to commit suicide. The professor is just looking through her diary, right? And he sees the dead bodies. I'd be horrified. I'd want to go to the police, but I don't think I would throw myself off a balcony.
Yeah, I was looking this up to make sure I didn't miss anything. And it really does seem like he just killed himself out of this sense of guilt over what happened. I wasn't sure if there was maybe something subtle about maybe it wasn't a full affair, but maybe he was aware of this and like just never did anything to stop it. And that's why he felt guilty, because he's a professor and she was a student of his. But it's not really satisfying.
And he had a stack of letters. He had a stack of letters in his locker from her. Mm-hmm. I think he either ignored them or just brushed them off. But yeah, really little bit of overkill. Huh?
I appreciate a horror movie where the deaths start early and occur often, though, because we pretty quickly get the next one, which is Yoko the caretaker very undeservedly dying.
I know. Poor thing. She's taking care of the granny, right? And then hears a noise upstairs, goes to investigate, and gets sucked into the attic.
Yeah, she sticks her head up in there and you see her legs, you know, dangling down, getting rattled about. And she gets turned into a ghost too, because we see her and with her jaw ripped off.
That's rough. Yeah, she becomes basically another Onryo because we see her take out her boss in a way.
Yeah, it's like the Onryo can create more Onryo by passing this trauma. It's like, oh, we're going to traumatize you in death, and that's going to make you into a little vengeful spirit too. I thought the kill that came next with Emma, the elderly mother, was really cool because I really liked the effect of Kayako's ghost.
Yes, this giant abyss monster covered in hair is what it looks like to me. And it's so creepy. I remember being so freaked out by it the first time I saw it. And it really harnesses this hair motif that we also see in our Onryos.
It does. The first time I saw it, I thought that it looked like a sea creature or something kind of tentacly or, you know, water adjacent. And it is such a satisfying payoff when you find out it's because she drowned.
Yeah. Yeah. Matt and Jennifer, who are son and daughter-in-law to Emma, they are found in the attic, but we see Jennifer die of fright. The ghost comes after her. She's kind of alone in the house. And when Matt comes to find her, he just sees her in this really freaky catatonic state, making like a croaking sound. And she dies. I think, does the ghost show itself again at this point? And mm-hmm. It cuts. So we assume they both die of fright. I'm assuming. Yeah. I don't know if that's true or not. But we do find their bodies later.
We do. And it's kind of written off as a murder-suicide by the detectives. But it just kind of adds to the overall mystery of what's going on here. The other undeserved death is Yoko's boss, Alex, which we mentioned. You know, Yoko becomes a spirit. And so she goes after her manager, which I was like, her manager's kind of nebbish and seems like maybe not an amazing person, but he doesn't seem to deserve to be murdered or vengefully murdered.
No, he's a caretaker manager. He cares about people, right? You would assume that's why he's in this industry. And he doesn't do anything. He just assigns people to go help people. Yeah, it's very sad. This is another death that you don't see. It's off screen. So basically every time that happens, I just assume this person dies of fright. Unless you see what happens, like in Yoko's case. Susan is another daughter of Emma. She has, I think, the scariest death of all. Because she is at work, working late, and the ghost has followed her to her place of work and follows her home. That's like the first time we really see the ghost leave the house.
Yeah, this is such good dramatic irony, watching Susan knowing that she's being followed by this spirit and that it's just going to get her. Is this the scene where we see her on the elevator with the boy getting progressively closer? Yeah, it's mm-hmm. so creepy. And she's just so mm-hmm. blissfully unaware. And she's making her way home. You know, she's calling the house because she's worried about her mom. She doesn't realize yet that her brother and sister-in-law's already dead. The mom's already dead. And when she gets home, she gets sucked into the mattress, which I didn't even think was an option.
Yeah. Something similar to that, I think, happens in Poltergeist, right? Doesn't somebody get sucked under the bed? Or it might be Poltergeist too, I forget. She does exactly what I would do at that point. You know, she goes outside. She sees her brother through the peephole. She goes outside. There's nobody anywhere. Her brother is nowhere to be found. And she's hearing things on the phone. She throws the phone on the ground. It breaks and it's still making that horrible croaking sound. And so she runs inside and dives under the covers because there's no, like, what else is she supposed to do? It's a ghost. Yeah, that's exactly what I would do. I would just give up.
It's so relatable.
Next, the movie takes us back in time. Like mm-hmm. we get this flashback and we find out what has happened to the family in this house. So we get three deaths at once. Kayoko and Toshio are the mother and son who get killed by her husband. And then Kayako comes back and immediately kills her husband. Her spirit takes him out.
Instant death for the husband. Yeah. Some real Onryo shit right there.
I really think he overreacted.
I can't believe that he was like, I'm so angry. I'm going to kill our child and our cat. Like, what the fuck?
And our cat. Like,
yeah. Jeez. He just goes on this rampage. But question, when we see the spirit of the little boy Toshio throughout the movie, Sarah Michelle Gellar can see him. He's kind of bruised and cut up. I had assumed that was because the dad was just abusive in general. to the boy when he was alive, and that this wasn't coming from nowhere. It wasn't like he went from zero to murdering his whole family. It's like maybe he was already an abusive person who then escalated to killing his family.
I don't know, Kate. The newspaper said he was a loving father and husband, so the media lie to us.
I'm sure he was.
That would make more sense as to why he snapped and why she would even be this infatuated, right? Something's wrong at home, so she looks for fulfillment elsewhere, or is just so wrapped up in her own fantasy that this is her escape, right, from her family life, if it's not good. So I think it's just anybody's guess. Otherwise, I would assume the cuts and scratches are just from his final beating and drowning, right? I imagine there was some thrashing and maybe the cat was in the, no, the cat died first, so that wouldn't be it. But I kind of just, in my mind, just threw it in with the drowning. But I think that's a good observation. That's a good guess as to how this all happened, because it really seems like a huge overreaction to some letters and diary entries.
Totally. It is very gross how Bill Pullman finds the bodies, which is because of the flies.
Yeah.
Horrible.
And their bodies are just in the attic. It must have smelled terrible.
Yeah. I think it's one of those things where if you smelled a terrible smell and saw flies, I don't think you would need to investigate further. Your spidey senses should be alerting you as to what's happening.
Right.
Speaking of spidey senses, some deaths that occur off screen but are mentioned by our detective here is that the past three detectives who tried to investigate what was going on with this house all died.
I guess they weren't memorable enough to be given a death scene, but because they investigated this murder, they're dead. That's just how it goes in this house.
Mm-hmm. And our last death is probably one of the more memorable ones. It's Sarah Michelle Gellar's boyfriend. This was kind of their big, not even standoff, because standoff would imply that they have a chance against this spirit in the house.
Sarah Michelle tries to burn the house down with everyone inside, including herself and her boyfriend.
I know.
And I'm like, what's going to happen if you burn down the house to the ghost? Nothing.
Right.
It's a ghost.
It's a ghost. Yeah. I don't think that's how you appease spirits.
I don't believe that this girl who is so out of touch with Japanese culture and the language would know how to defeat an Onryo. So I don't think the fire would have worked.
I don't think so either.
But Jason Bear is the first time you actually see somebody die of fright.
Yeah, with good cause.
Because nothing actually happens to him. Yeah.
We get this excellent scene of the Onryo coming down the stairs in this really jerky, almost stop motion movement that's so unsettling. It's so great. And that's what gets him. It's the just utter fear and panic.
Well, I wanted to talk about that a little bit, because the idea of dying of fright seems very silly to me. It seems like a trope that would just be made up for a movie, but it turns out it's real. It's sort of like a version of dying of shock in a way. So what happens when you are scared to death is you get this crazy adrenaline rush into your heart, and it forces calcium into your heart passageways and causes it to seize. And it can seize like that for so long or so tensely that it kills you. Really, the only way to prevent this is to be as healthy as possible so that if it happens, you can survive it.
Do you have any examples?
What I was reading is that this typically happens in situations of life or death. So if you're trying to escape a tornado, or if you're being chased by a killer. There's actually an example of this in North Carolina, where a man was charged with first-degree murder of a 79-year-old woman because he scared her during a robbery. He didn't touch her, but he scared her so hard that she died, and he was charged with murder.
That's wild, and seems like something that would happen in North Carolina.
But the more common ways to die from actual shock are, and I'll list this in order of most common to least common, but cardiogenic shock, so like a heart problem, which this would probably fall under. Hypovolemic shock, which is when you lose so much blood in your body or fluids, you lose about 1/5. I imagine this would have happened to our pals at the end of Saw 5.
Oh, yeah.
When they are cutting off their arms. But this is actually the second most common type of shock and the most common type children get. And it's usually from diarrhea in underdeveloped countries. Next is anaphylactic shock, which is an allergic reaction, septic shock due to infection, and finally, neurogenic shock, which is damage to the nervous system.
Interesting.
The highest mortality rate is the, like we said, the cardiogenic shock, and that's about 30-40%.
That's high.
If that happens to your, yeah, a third of these people die.
Wow.
Crazy.
So we get some great deaths in this movie. We talked about how the movie is presented in a non-linear fashion, and it's because this is not just a horror movie, but it's also kind of a mystery movie.
You mentioned to me that you thought Karen was supposed to be intuitive. And I'll be honest with you, I never got the sense that she was intuitive in this movie. All the times I've seen it, I've never once thought that.
This is me bending over backwards to justify why certain things happen for Karen that don't happen to other people, and why she also might have some degree of plot armor. Is she's our main character. The movie opens with her having this cute little bantery exchange with her boyfriend where she happens to know what he's looking for, where it is, and she knew he was going to be running late, so she set the clocks an hour ahead. So they're trying to establish something. Is it that she's clever? Is it that she's intuitive or extremely practical? Who knows? Because none of that sticks. In this first scene, she is able to see visions of the ghost and the boy. She hears the cat-like sound and is in the house multiple times, over and over, seeing these things on the bus when she's out in the world. And yet the ghost never comes for her. And so I was like doing all these mental gymnastics to figure out, why would she be able to experience these things, get through this movie without being affected by it? Well, maybe she's got some kind of ghost intuition, or is sometimes in these like supernatural movies, there's a prescience that someone has about the ghostly world, and then that lets them commune with it in some ways. I'm reaching heavily to try and make this make sense because it really doesn't.
I didn't get that either, why she gets to get away with being in that house for so long, especially when you see how quickly Jason Bear got it at the end. And you know what, Kate? I didn't even bother to worry about it. I just thought, well, she's the main character, so I guess she's just going to see shit. But yeah, I don't understand. They've set up these character traits for her, but to me, they don't really seem to help her or relate to what's going on at all. If she's doing these things for her boyfriend to help him stay on top of things or just help him stay organized, I don't understand how that correlates to the ghost letting her keep on keeping on. If that makes sense.
No, it's very poorly conceived characterization. I think that there's maybe some germs of an idea around what kind of person she could be and why she would be allowed to survive this movie, but it doesn't really go anywhere. And I would say that, you know, there's not a lot of depth in any of the other characters either. It's just tough because you want to believe, or I want to believe, that there's something special about her because she's in the house over and over and over. She's being followed by this ghost, and then just nothing happens. So it doesn't, I don't know. It doesn't make any sense.
And we're following her.
Yeah. We want to know. When I was watching this movie, I wanted to know, okay, what happened to create this ghost? Because there's something here related to the guy committing suicide at the beginning and this boy. And then I wanted to know, what is up with Sarah Michelle Gellar's character? Why is she getting through this? And we get a very, very definitive answer to one and then nothing for the other, which is very frustrating for kind of a mystery horror movie.
Yeah, that would probably, if I let that sit in my mind while I was watching this, probably bother me a lot more and lower my score for this film, for sure.
Yeah, it's just a little like nitpick that I feel like I can just keep on ranting about.
She is the one tracking the mystery. She's the one investigating. She makes little printouts and takes them with her and connects the dots between the professor and the family and does some investigation. It's very surface level investigation. It's stuff you would find on a Google search.
We do get an early 2000s Google montage, as is required by law in any mystery movie of the time.
Yes. Oh my God. It's so hard to make searching the net look cool.
And they fail to do it again in this one.
Yeah.
One of the mysteries that we're trying to figure out here is, you know, who is the ghost or ghosts, because we do see multiple. And they're presented in a way that's really unusual for American audiences. But as we mentioned, the Onryo-type spirits earlier totally makes sense for a Japanese audience.
Yeah, and you have quite a bit of info on Onryo. We did touch on it earlier, but there's a lot more to go into.
Yeah, as we mentioned, it's part of Japanese traditional belief and folklore about these types of vengeful spirits. They're typically women. So we do see Kayako in this movie is our main Onryo. She's the one primarily, you know, murdering people. Yoko is turned into an Onryo as well. The little boy is kind of acting more as a lure or just like an additional spirit in the house, not necessarily like a full Onryo. But the depiction of them is based very heavily influenced on kabuki style villains. So in kabuki theater, these villains would be wearing typically white burial kimonos. They would have wild, unkempt, long black hair. We see this also with Samara in The Ring. Yeah, that super long hair. And then typically a white, very dramatically painted face with then, you know, very dark shadows in gray, blue, or indigo around the eyes to kind of draw that contrast, which is exactly what Toshio and Kayako look like in this movie.
And The Ring. And it made the blue filter on both of these movies make so much more sense to me stylistically. Mm-hmm. Of course, that's perfect. I love that they don't show a kimono. They don't use white foundation, but you get the translation from this traditional spirit to this modern day movie. All of these Onryos have crazy long black hair. It's messy. Even Samara had that. They are just white. They just look pale and like they haven't seen the sun. The ghosts in these movies just are white with blue, the blue filter, but also have that blue shadowy look to them. So I thought that was really cool to understand why they look the way they look. And it's very entrenched in tradition.
And I think is a nice knock against the haters of this movie, because I think that people were like, oh, there was a villain in The Ring that already had all of these characteristics, and now we're seeing the same thing in The Grudge. Yeah, because it's a cultural depiction of an angry spirit. We have Western depictions of angry spirits that follow a lot of motifs and tropes, or even just ghosts in general that we do that aren't what they use in East Asia. So I think it is a cool touch, and I think that is something that people just weren't maybe as culturally open-minded about learning about these mm-hmm. types of things at the time, and so they just instead were like, oh, it's copying.
Yeah, right. We get a lot of ghost motifs that sort of help plug in the clues of what is going on with these ghosts. Why are they there? How did they die? Who are they? So I guess we could just go through them and talk about where they're coming from with these ghosts. the one motif that stands out to me the most is that choking sound. It's like a choking, creaking, weird sound. That sound that Kyoko makes whenever she's terrorizing people. Did you catch where that sound came from or why that sound exists?
I didn't actually.
Yeah, I caught this on like the third time through, and it's when, yeah, I know, when you go up to the attic, you hear the creaking of the floorboards, and that's the sound that's coming out of her mouth. I was like, oh, that's it. I was totally lost on where that sound came from.
It's very clever. It's almost like its own Easter egg to figure that out.
The next big sound we hear is the black cat, the mm-hmm. screeching cat. And the sound comes out of the boy's mouth. You never actually see the cat making this sound.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think they did that? Why do you think they combined the two?
I wasn't sure. I wasn't sure if it was because they were drowned in the same tub sequentially, and so their spirits were absorbed into each other or something. And so the boy made the cat howling noise. Did you have a theory, or did you know why it was happening?
I was kind of thinking the same thing. The cat got it first. The little boy was next immediately after. And I kind of just imagined that there must have been a very tender bond between the two, right? The boy and the cat may have been very close, which is sort of a funny thing to say, but little kids get very close to their pet friends, right? Mm-hmm. So I was thinking that could have been why the two of them were bonded in death through this sound.
Yeah, I think so. And I think that the method of death, the drowning, then impacted the other motifs that we see.
Right, because the blue is a stylistic choice, but it also, like you said earlier, is reminiscent of water and drowning and what happens to your skin when you no longer have oxygen in it. That blue is not just a stylistic thing. It's also totally tied to the deaths of these three. I say three characters because I'm thinking of the cat. But yeah, these three deaths.
Yeah. I mean, we have multiple scenes oriented around the bathtub, seeing a spirit in the bath. When Sarah Michelle Gellar is showering, that hand comes through her hair in the water. Lots of water bath related things related to their deaths.
Hair, like we mentioned earlier, is a huge motif. We see it all over the place. Not just the hair monster that comes after Emma, but hair is always hiding the face of the monster until it reveals the eyes, which gives it a lot more tension, right? You don't want to see what's behind the hair. And it's revealed to be this, you know, freaky face choking at you. It's a really scary, creepy motif.
So the last thing that we see with these ghosts is how rigid their movements are. We talked about how jerky Kayako comes down the stairs at the end to scare the boyfriend to death. So unnerving, so bizarre. I assumed it was like a rigor mortis type effect happening.
I have to imagine that's definitely a big part of it. There is a really quick shot of the husband when he starts to lose his mind in the flashback, where he twitches his head and his neck, mm-hmm. and his hands start to freeze up because he's so mad and tense. And so I wasn't sure if it was sort of related to that, even though it wasn't her movements. Those movements were indicative of his rage. And so maybe that transferred to the ghosts. Not sure, but that was my guess.
Yeah, I could see that. I really enjoyed this movie. It had been a very long time since I had seen it. And I thought it would maybe suffer a little bit from watching it right up against The Ring in this season. But it is just a very solid entry into the ghost movie canon.
I like this movie a lot, and I would recommend it. I think the 50% is unfair. I don't think it's accurate either. This movie has a couple of plot holes, but it's still fun to watch and has a lot of good creepy things in it. It's a great movie to watch if you want to get creeped out. So, great movie. Glad we covered it. I also had not seen it in a while. And to be honest, I thought it held up really well.
Yeah, it was a fun look back into early 2000s film style.
Oh, early college make.
And seeing like what the tropes were, but then also through a new lens, seeing it in Japan, seeing the Onryo style ghost. And I'm really glad that we got to do a deep dive into some of the cultural stuff, because I feel like I just genuinely learned a lot about J-horror. Same. By watching these movies. Yeah. Well, this was our final entry into our ghost movies for the year. Make sure to stick around. We've got one more new movie coming out before we wrap up 2023. But thanks for joining us on this journey through the past year.
And please don't forget to rate us in the Apple Podcast Store. It'll really help us on our way to becoming certified tomato meter critics. This was Not Quite Dead.
Check out our other episodes wherever you listen to podcasts.
Follow us on Instagram at Not Quite Dead Podcast. And on Twitter at NQD_podcast.
Follow our blog for bonus content at notquitedeadpodcast.com.
Thanks for listening.
And happy watching.